Order of the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is March 2nd, 2011, and we are convened for the purpose of introducing one committee measure, which we'll do later.
That's right.
A public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 329 and Senate Bill 372. By the way, I don't anticipate that I will be moving those today. And then we will have a public hearing first. That's going to be our first agenda item on Senate Bill 653, 716, 717, and 718. And the reason we're doing that first is because we have some people who are waiting by the phones around the state who are small business people from Vail Burns who would like to comment on this bill, and I want them to be able to get back to making a living as quickly as possible.
Absolutely.
So, colleagues, I also wanted to call your attention to some information in your packet, and I think we've provided it for the public as well. The first is a document by the insurance division that includes the assessments that the various health insurers pay. If you look at the middle column, the funding assessment is what they pay to the insurance division for the privilege of being regulated, I suppose. And as most of you know, no dollars from the insurance division come from the general fund. It is all funded on assessments paid by the insurers to their regulators. I also wanted to call your attention to an article from the Insurance Journal that is entitled "Iowa Commissioner: Wellmark May Increase Rates by 8.5%, not 10.8%," and it discusses the hearing process that they have in the state of Iowa. Additionally, on page, I wanted to share this page with you, which is from the Insurance Division's report, Health Insurance in Oregon 2011, and it includes annual premiums by state in the small group market, and it lists where Oregon falls on that spectrum, as well as where Iowa does, where they have some hearings, and it's significantly lower annual premiums than Oregon. Additionally, I thought I'd share with you some information about how Maine does its hearing process and the rate review process. This is from the maine.gov website, and that information is also available. And two more pieces. There's this report, which is actually from 2003. It's very dated, but it has some very neutrally presented information about health insurance rate regulation in Arizona from 2003, and I found it interesting that on page 9 they talk of 9 states, almost 20% of all states in the union, having some type of hearing process. 20% of all states having some type of hearing process. And then finally, you've heard me reference over the last couple of weeks the fact that medical utilization has been declining, at least when you look at the earnings statements of the big insurers, Aetna, Cigna, Humana, United, and the like, that medical utilization has been falling for the last year. And that's that document right there. So that being said, I just wanted to bring you up to date on the information that you had before you, and we are going to jump into opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 653, 716, 717, and 718. Patrick, I'll save you from having to describe all those bills.
Sure.
It is listed there, and in just a few moments we will call for testimony by phone a business owner in Rhode Island, a gentleman named Bill Martin, who is the founder and partner of Epivax to talk about his experience with the Rhode Island rate review process. Any comments? All right. Patrick, why don't we go ahead and make that phone call then? Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. We have a more important dignitary in our midst, and I thank you, Patrick. For that's why we have two of us. Senator Beyer, if you could please.
Mr. Chair, I want you to know it wouldn't happen on my committee, so my bill should go through your committee. So.
Senator Beyer would like to make some opening comments.
I'm Lee Beyer, Senator representing District 6, which is Central Lynn and Lane counties. And when I seen the bills posted and was talking with the chair, I said I'd like to come down and just make some observations, not specific to any one of the bills, but in general. I had the opportunity during the interim to work a little bit with Senator Shields on one of the rate review systems, trying to open that up a little bit, which I think is a good idea. It's no surprise, I think, to any of us that health care insurance costs have been skyrocketing, and I don't like they're going anywhere but up. And I'm of the solid belief that if you open the process to a little more transparency and maybe some intervention through a public hearing process, that could we could help mitigate some of that. It's certainly insurance companies are not the the sole or even maybe the even major reason why the rates are going up, but I think we have to look at a lot of these things, and this is one. My interest in this, and besides wanting to keep rates as low as possible, is from my experience of 9 years as a public utility commissioner. And one of my observations from that period of time is when you open the process to a public review and public hearings, and particularly when you allow professional intervention in that process, it's amazing the things that you can uncover and things that you can do to cause a little more downward pressure on the rates. And I think that our insurance system, as it exists now, while I'm not going to fault anybody for it, is a fairly closed process and could use a little more sunlight in it. And so my purpose for coming today is just to, from my somewhat limited experience, if you will, is to say, and I would encourage you to think about this, think about the suggestions of opening the process to more professional intervention, and particularly using an open hearings process with a what's called a contested case format. I think it would bear fruit for hard-pressed Oregon families trying to buy health insurance. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some general comments, and I wish you well.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. We're gonna call now Bill Martin from Rhode Island, founder and partner in Epivax. Hi, this is State Senator Chip Shields calling from Oregon. We have an appointment with Bill Martin. Is he available, please?
Yes. What's your last name? Fields?
Shields. S-H.
Shields. Okay. One moment, please.
Thank you.
You weren't very important, Mr. Chair. Here you are with a committee of 75 of our closest friends.
Yes. Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Yes.
You are live and on the microphone at the Oregon State Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. This is Chip Shields.
Okay, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. And we are convened to discuss four bills related to health insurance rate review, and if you could give us your perspective on how things have worked in Rhode Island, you can begin your testimony at any moment.
Okay, great. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen, chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Martin. I am a founder and currently a partner in a small biotech company called Epivax, located in Providence, Rhode Island. I am also the co-chair of the Rhode Island Health Insurance Commissioners Citizens Advisory Committee. Always a mouthful when I have to say that. And as the chairman says, I'm here to offer some of my experiences as they relate to the open rate review process here in Rhode Island, and specifically to your Bill 717. I think it's important to note here that I am not a lawyer, and I am not an expert with respect to the legal mechanics of the rate review process, but I do have some experience with how the public participation has worked here in Rhode Island. As an owner of a small company, you know, the high cost of health insurance is a very real and sort of tangible concern to me. You know, it's one of the things my employees get most worked up about at the end of the year when we see our rate increases come in. When we started the company in 1998, we didn't have any health insurance. We were the two of us that were here were in the individual market, Like most people, we found that to be expensive and difficult proposition. And as soon as we could afford it, we contracted for group coverage at Epivax. And although that was an improvement relative to the individual market, we've still seen our premiums rise to an almost unbearable degree. So several years ago, when the Health Insurance Commissioner formed his advisory board, he asked me to join that. And at the time, I knew very little about the health insurance industry, about how rates were set. But I was concerned, and I said yes, I would. And now, after several years, I'm a co-chair on that board. So here in Rhode Island, rate review is an annual process, and basically in the springtime, insurance companies submit their rate requests. The commissioner has the option to accept or reject. I think that's more or less the same way it is in Oregon. And, of course, the insurers also have the option to withdraw and resubmit. If the submissions are rejected by the commissioner and the insurance companies are unwilling to accept that, they do have a legal appeal process that moves from the office of the Health Insurance Commissioner to the Attorney General's office, and I do not have experience with that part of the review cycle. So for the past several years, the Commissioner has been bringing the details of the rate reviews to the Advisory Board. At first, the insurance companies were very reluctant to share. They were concerned that there were trade secrets there and that they didn't want everyone to see. We were given submissions that were heavily redacted to the point that they were sort of pointless. There were just lots of big, heavy black marks in the middle of the pages. But over time, we sort of, through some cajoling from the commissioner, I think, and maybe a little confidence building with the commission, we were able to get full access to those rate review documents. And we started to get the details of their rate requests. And unfortunately, that was a little bit of a disappointing event for us, because we found that we went from looking at a black box to looking at a fairly messy box. Many of the details were insufficient. Key pieces of information were missing. So maybe you had a per member per month cost, but you didn't have the denominator. Highly disorganized. And then we were also finding that some of the information was incomplete. Some was contradicting other parts of the submission. It really took several cycles to get those documents to a point where a layperson could really, you know, get some idea of what was going on there. But we did eventually get to that point, and we're starting to actually get a picture of what drives cost increases in Rhode Island. Some of that, of course, is exactly what you'd expect. I mean, utilization and inflation are one of the big factors. And having that good information about what's really driving costs from the insurer's point of view has allowed the commissioner to negotiate some lower rate increases for the state. And it's also allowed us to focus resources where we think we can get some good return on investment, and that's what's known here as the affordability project. And within that project, we're looking at payment reform, we're looking at the establishment of medical homes, we're looking at establishment of electronic medical records. And also, I think important here is that we're also looking closely at the contracting process between insurers and the major providers, the hospitals. And we're sort of at the beginning of that cycle and seeing the same sort of thing we saw with the rate reviews, which is to say a lot of reluctance about sharing, and is this really proprietary information, but little by little we're starting to get access into those contract negotiations and seeing what people are really paying for these various services and how they are paying differently from one hospital to the next. We're also looking closely at administrative costs and some of the cross subsidies that are embedded in those commercial rate structures, which I believe are an important driver of cost for the commercial ratepayer. So, you know, those subsidies sort of net out if you're looking at the system as a whole. But for that one third of us who are paying commercial rates, subsidies to people like self-insured companies and to states, I have to say, who are underpaying for Medicare and Medicaid, can actually be driving commercial rates. So, and I can say on a related topic that the office of the Health Insurance Commissioner here in Rhode Island is very small, just two or three people. They do this rate review process for three insurers in a 3 or 4 month period. It is a large task for them, but it does not dominate their lives to the exclusion of all else. And this can definitely be done in a relatively short time frame with a small number of people. And I can also say that we haven't had really significant adverse impacts from opening this process up. Very few complaints from the insurers about the effort required to compile a rate review package, and the details, although they are public, have not become part of the public debate. So there has not been a penalty to pay for releasing those details, at least to this point. The bottom line, of course, is still, something that does get into the public debate, and, whether it's 10% or 9% or 8%, but the details of 1% for this or 2% for that have not been political football to get kicked around. So from my point of view, and certainly the insurance companies would have their own opinions, but from my point of view, I'm not seeing that this open process has had any impact on the competitive positions of these companies or their bottom line. And to this date, I don't think any of our rate review decisions have been appealed. So it would seem that at least at some level, it's working for the insurance company. I would say that, Rhode Island is a small market state. We have just three carriers. And when you take that small size and you combine it with the way that health insurance is sold and regulated and purchased from hospitals on long-term contracts, it pretty much guarantees that the providers, the insurance providers, are looking at a fairly static competitive landscape. There's not a lot of dynamic tension in this market. And I think in that environment, one of the roles of the regulating authority is to provide a proxy for competitive pressure. And, sometimes that can be difficult if that regulating agency and the people they are regulating get into a very comfortable relationship. So I think giving the public a role has helped to maintain a nice balance between the needs of the industry and the needs of the consumer. And, to be sure, the industry has needs. It's in no one's interest to drive insurance companies or hospitals out of business, and that's not the point here. But neither is it in anybody's interest to drive the small businesses to drop their health insurance. So looking for that balance has helped us focus on the real issue here, which is rising costs and not on finding the bad guy. So, overall, I would say that public oversight has worked in Rhode Island. I think it has led, maybe only indirectly to reduced rate increases. I know that Rhode Island has had lower rate increases than many other states in the last few years. And I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Bill, thank you very much for that testimony. Is there any questions for Bill from the panel? Seeing none, Bill, well, thank you very much. I know that you're 3 hours ahead of us there, and we really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to help us wade through how to help keep health insurance premiums low for Oregon small business.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye, Bill.
Bye-bye.
All right. So we've got up next Judge Steve Grasty from Harney County and then Bruce Lawson from Vail, Oregon, and then we'll have some words from the opponents of the bill, and then we'll go back into the panel. And if anybody has not signed up at this point, do we have maybe is anybody not signed up and still wants to testify at this point?
The hearing,
okay.
All three
together.
So if he's an opponent,
Judge Grassley's office. This is Sharon.
Hi, Sharon. This is State Senator Chip Shields calling from Salem. We are live in the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. I was wondering if Judge Grasty might be available, please.
He is available. If I can put you on hold for just one moment, I'll get him.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Harney County's coming pretty good. They got the whole legislature on hold now.
So the Harney County judge would be like a county chair.
Yes, county commissioner.
Well, chair of the county commission, wouldn't he?
Yeah, we're all judges. Well, they're it's all a home rule state. Home rule county state or whatever, Hound County or whatever.
Yeah, I know several of the eastern Oregon counties have judges instead of commissioners. But it's confusing sometimes when you think a judge with black robe and gavel.
You saw those commissioners were going to think that.
Hi, this is Steve Grasty.
Judge Grasty, hi. You are live in the General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. This is State Senator Chip Shields. We have on the panel with us Senator Boquist, Senator Monroe, and Senator Bonamici. And we are convened for a public hearing, as you know, on four bills, and we would love to get your perspective on them. So fire away with your testimony when you are ready.
Senator, are you the chair?
I am, yes.
Thank you. So for the record, this is Steve Grasty, and I'm Harney County Judge in Burns, Oregon. And I think you probably have written testimony from me. In particular, I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 717. And I want to start out by saying thanks for allowing me to testify this way. Today is one of our regular county court meetings, and we are trying to conduct the business of this county. So I'd like to begin by saying I want to encourage support in the passage of Senate Bill 717. As a small business owner here in Burns for many years and for the past 12 years as a county elected official, the one unknown that we hear year after year is how much will health insurance rates increase? Not if they will, but how much they will.
Yeah.
In my 30-plus years of management and administration, I think I can only recall one year in which there was a single-digit increase. All the others were double-digit. In my business, I participated in three or four different Oregon business associations to try and level insurance costs more than anything else. That was the reason I participated in those associations. And the one lesson that we learned was that insurance rates were set inside some kind of a black box, and no individual or business was going to be part of that conversation. It was just, here comes the rates at you. There was a secret that apparently would have challenged us or prevented the providers from being able to compete. And I learned that it was impossible for my business to provide any real input into those rates and rate increases. And we just simply waited each year to see how much of an increase it was going to be and how we could work it into our budgets. That same fact is true, less so perhaps now, but is true about local government, and we're a little above the size of the small businesses described in these three set of bills. But in my business, what I did eventually is I just gave the employees a raise large enough to cover that year's health insurance cost and told them, if it goes up from here, it's going to be your responsibility, and quit helping them. And it was a hard decision for me to make. It's fairly simple on them the first year, but as years went by, it just progressively got worse for them. So I think that an open hearing process will allow for input. It's going to put real faces on the folks that are impacted by rate changes. And I believe that this is one area that impacts so many of us in this state, whether you're rural or urban, that it must be done in an open and transparent process. I've got to admit, I'm getting tired of the use of open and transparent in government speech of late, but I do think it's an appropriate term here. I think this bill will not resolve the issue of increases, but it will let a public process happen that all get to hear and all get to be able to participate in to the level they want. And perhaps such a hearing process will bring realism and pressure on a system that has quickly, or perhaps already has, exceeded the ability of the people and the businesses in this state to pay for rising insurance costs. And I'll close with that, but again, thanks for letting me testify this way, and I'd answer any questions if there are any.
Any questions for Judge Grasty? Seeing none on the panel, thank you very much for your testimony, Judge Grasty. We really appreciate it.
All right, and thank you again to this, Senator.
All right, bye-bye.
He's okay.
Okay. All right, good. Next up is going to be Bruce Lawson. He's the owner of Homeland Fireworks in Vail, and then after that we'll have some comments from Steve Bender from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Do we have one last round of the bills?
Bruce Lawson, this is State Senator Chip Shields. You are live at the General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee here in Salem.
Okay.
And we really appreciate you taking time out from you making a living to come give your perspective on the four bills that we have up in public hearing. So whenever you're ready, please feel free to dive into your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call and what you folks are doing. I'm happy to say that I support these bills of the, you know, the insurance costs. Something needs to be done to where, you know, the small guy can try to hang in there. My story is fairly simple. My wife and I, Barbara, own and operate a fireworks display company. We're a full service company that folks can hire, cities can hire, where we come in and we're fully insured. We have the trained crew, the equipment, we set up, we shoot a display, we clean up, and go home. With that being said, I'm insured in every aspect that you can imagine, through transportation, workman's comp, event liabilities, property liabilities, because of this business. And with all these soaring insurance premiums, I'm just getting dinged from all sides. And when Senator Chip Shields gave me a call, I was more than happy to stand up for this and support this these bills. Barbie, my wife and I, Barbara, were just talking today, and we started our insurance in August of 2008. I didn't want to because of the high costs, but due to our operating loan, our bankers and stuff had asked us to do that, which they incorporated it into our operating loan. So not, you know, I'm getting dinged on insurance there as well. And it's been a good thing. However, we have two parts of our insurance, and the reason why is I got denied on my insurance due to the fact that I have ankylosing spondylitis, which is a arthritis that attacks my back and my hip, and all my bigger joints as far as the wear and tear. So with that, I'm thankful that I have the insurance. But in August of 2008, when they started me, I was paying $754 a month for our insurance. And then my wife and three girls, their premiums were $413 a month. From 2008 till present day, I went from $754 to $1,046 a month for myself. My wife and two daughters, starting at $413, and today they're $533. And so with that being said, I'm paying about $1,600 a month, which I've got to tell you that we raised our three children. We have a boy that just turned 24, or 23, and then I have two daughters. Both of them are in college there in LeGrand. And we raised on the farm here before we started into our fireworks business. We were paid on a monthly salary of $1,200 a month. And, you know, it just frustrates me. And I don't know how people can pay for this, but yet it's something that you need. And being self-employed, I can't go down and get state assistance, you know, insurance to cover my family. So this is something that I'm hoping that you folks can put your head together there. And again, I appreciate what you're doing, and anything can help. I did talk to my insurance provider here, my local broker that wrote that up, and he is preparing me for another increase here yet this year. To be ready for it, and I just, you know, he also mentioned that I will be losing some of my benefits, and I guess that would be pretty much maybe some of my prescriptions, and I think there's a couple other things, but I just want to let you folks know that our deductible is still. I believe it's $1,500 per person. So, you know, it takes us a while. My daughter had blood work done here a couple weeks ago, and you know, just the blood work alone. Of course, I know that has nothing to do with the insurance, but you know, it was $700. $500. My wife just corrected me, and you know, so that goes towards the deductible. But it's just a lot of money. But anyway, that's my story. I don't know if it affects or helps or whatever. But I support the bills and Homeland Fireworks and Bruce and Barbie Lawson and our family, and I just appreciate all what you're doing there.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Lawson. We'll let me see if we have any questions from the committee. No questions from the committee. We'll let you go back to make a living. Thanks so much for weighing in on this topic. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye.
Colleagues, if we could please welcome up to the table. Steve Bender from Legislative Fiscal. He is the LFO officer for DCBS, and one of the things that we'll need to grapple with is if we do decide to go down the road of providing more public process, if it ends up costing more, how are we going to pay for that? So I was hoping he could give some comments about the nature of the insurance division's budget, as well as update us on some federal grants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Bender with the Legislative Fiscal Office. The Insurance Division is a division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and typically in the past they have funded their operations through what we in the budget call other funds, which is to say assessments that they are charged to insurance companies that finance the operations of the Insurance Division. Recently, though, last September to be more precise, the division was awarded a federal grant that became available under the Affordable Care Act to expand their rate review activities. And this became a new source of funding for the division and for this particular program within the division. The division was awarded a $1 million grant under Cycle 1 of a series of grants that are being offered by the Department of Health and Human Services for rate review activities. The $1 million represented about basically tripled the funding within the department's budget for rate review activities. The department had been spending approximately $475,000 per year on rate review prior to the receipt of this grant. The grant amount was for $1 million for a one-year period. So that would represent a tripling of the funding for that particular year. If I may, Mr. Chair, I did want to just briefly mention the legislature's how the awarding of federal grants is handled in the budget by the legislature. There are a number of processes that occur before an agency can spend any federal monies. And basically, there are two steps to this process. The first step is that the agency has to obtain, by law, permission to apply for the grant before they submit an application to the federal government. This is a process that does not involve the entire legislative assembly. It involves either the Ways and Means Committee during a session or the Emergency Board during an interim. During an interim, sometimes these applications are approved retroactively because the meeting dates are so discontinuous that sometimes a deadline occurs before there's a meeting date. So the Emergency Board will approve retroactively an agency submission. That is what happened in September. When the legislature is in session, though, as it is now, agencies are not permitted to apply for federal monies prior to receiving approval by the Ways and Means Committee to do so. So that is the first stage. The Ways and Means Committee will review whether they would like the agency to apply for the particular grant, and typically the department looks at what the agency's statutory obligations are, how they're planning to utilize the grant funds, and whether there are any matching costs or ongoing costs that the state other state funds will have to bear. The second step in the legislative approval of the grant spending of grant monies is if the grant is actually awarded, then there has to be budget authority included in the agency's budget to allow them to actually spend the monies. So the process comes to a second, comes back a second time, and the legislature, Ways and Means Committee, has to make adjustments in the agency's budget to allow them to spend the grant funds. That, of course, does come before the full body in the form of the agency's budget bill that is forwarded for approval.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Benner?
Yes, Mr. Boquist. Senator Boquist.
Well, Senator Shields, I guess you don't know. I'm a big fan of other funds, so I'm probably the leading expert in the Senate side of this particular topic. Self-approved and self-attacked. So a couple quick questions here. You said it was a grant in September of last year, correct? So that's FY10 dollars. Is there an ending fund balance in our fiscal year that they're carrying over? And then what is the, is there a grant available in the proposed budget of fiscal year 11, which of course we're operating on a continuing resolution on right now?
Senator, I don't believe I can answer all of your questions accurately, but I do have information that may be of interest and of help to you. Firstly, the $1 million grant that was awarded, as you know, the federal fiscal years are different than our fiscal years.
Where do I?
The Emergency Board approved, I think it was $600,000 of expenditures that were expected to be made up to June 30th of this year.
Okay.
And $400,000 would need to be approved by you, the full legislature, for them to spend the remaining $400,000 in costs that are anticipated from the award that was already made. In terms of additional awards, I just received notification a day or so ago and haven't spoken to the department about this yet, but there is a new round of awards that are being offered by Health and Human Services. So I'm assuming that they have congressional, you know, approval in the budget to do this. And the department, the division will be requesting additional grant funds under this program, most assuredly.
I know, but this is your funding mechanism here, so I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair. I would suggest, I mean, the authorization has been approved, that is correct, but the actual appropriations have not been approved under the continuing resolution. So we probably need to check at that, and hopefully by the time we move a bill or something here, Mr. Chairman, Congress will have decided to do something for once, both parties, by the way, and get the budget passed, and then we'll have a knowledge what's there. But I do note for the record that there's $400,000 in the next biennium if the ending fund balance is actually there.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Boquist. Thank you, Mr. Benner. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate everybody hanging with us. We're going to now bring up, the comments. Could we bring up John Powell and Mike Becker?
I was getting away from Ways and Means here, but...
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services. I'm the committee assistant is handing out to the committee a letter prepared by our health plan in opposition to this package of rate review bills. I'd like to keep my comments relatively brief and focus on the fact that Providence shares the concerns of the prior folks who have testified in this committee and the citizens of this state that health care costs too much. The quality is variable, the health outcomes are inconsistent, and the system is complex and lacks coordination. We think that this legislature in 2009 set in place a very deliberative process that will address those issues in a very comprehensive way through the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Health Policy Board. Supplementing those efforts, the governor earlier this year put in place the Health System Transformation Team to come up with this comprehensive package of a revised and reordered healthcare delivery system that again will address those complex issues. I think if you look back at House Bill 2009, you will see that we passed, as part of that bill, a comprehensive set of reforms aimed at rate review. And let me just highlight a few of those components from House Bill 2009, passed in the 2009 session. This is in starting in section 27 through section 31. These are new components of rate review that were just put in place starting in 2009. A 30-day public comment period was added to the rate review process. Also added was the requirement that health insurers file with their rates a statement of administrative expenses and an explanation of the basis for the proposed premium rate increases. The Department of Insurance was given authority to identify what components of a rate filing would be confidential and not subject to public disclosure. And pursuant to rulemaking, the department held and issued a rule that nothing in the rate filing was confidential. It was all subject to public disclosure. The director then, new provisions were put in place to change the standard by which rate review was the standard by which rate review was determined. Previously, it was whether the rate was reasonable, not excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. That was the old standard. That standard is still in place, but added to that are the requirements that the director find that the rate, proposed rate, is actuarially sound, and also that the rate is based on reasonable administrative expenses. The director, in making those findings, is now allowed to consider the insurer's financial position, the historical and projected administrative costs, as well as medical and hospital expenses, historical and projected loss ratio, any anticipated change in the number of enrollees, changes in covered benefits and health benefit plan design, changes in health in the insurer's health care cost containment and quality improvement efforts. Consideration is also given to the insurer's solvency and rate stability. And then finally, any public comments are considered that have come in from that 30-day comment period that was also added as part of House Bill 2009. The model that Oregon has for rate review is one that has received national attention. We have one of the most comprehensive, transparent processes in the nation. And the ink is barely dried on this comprehensive change in our rate review process. Based on that, and the fact that the provisions of this package of bills would add redundancy and increase expenses and delays in the administrative process of rate review, we would ask that this committee consider not passing these bills out. And with that, I will take any comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Let's hear from Mr. Powell. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, we've also submitted a letter from Mr. Holt at Regents in opposition to the package of bills you have before you, as well as an attachment to that, noting that there are only five health insurance carriers admitted in the state of Rhode Island, and I believe in the individual market there's only one writing business in that state, which probably does lend itself perhaps more to the model that these bills would establish. I'd also point out on the page that you handed out to the committee from the insurance report that Rhode Island is the highest or one of the three or four highest in all categories of premium costs according to that chart. That chart was also based on 2009 data, which was prior to the new system that Mr. Becker just described going into effect in Oregon. So I would imagine next year the disparity between Oregon rates and Rhode Island rates would be even more stark. I think it would be instructive perhaps for the committee to look at other models of coverage of health care, including self-insurance, and perhaps get some self-insured entities to talk to you about their experience with health care. I know in PEB's case, within the last 2 weeks, their board has moved to add higher deductibles and copays to different benefits to try to bring their escalating costs and claims costs under control. So it is universal. Somebody looked at me with a blank stare today when I said some people don't think that the insurance division is doing a good job of reviewing rates. And for Regents, Mr. Chair, I can tell you they've done yeoman's work beyond our expectations.
Appreciate your testimony and your point of view, gentlemen. Any questions?
I have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if either of you, I didn't work on the package, the 2009 package in 2009. Were either of you part of the negotiations of that bill?
Senator Shields, Senator Bonamici, I was part of the negotiations when I was working for Regents, yes.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. And was there a discussion in discussing the rate review provisions that are in Senate Bill, or House Bill 2009, was there a discussion about public hearings and the advantage and or disadvantage of having public hearings as part of that process?
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, yes, there was a lot of discussion around rate review hearings. And in looking at the states, the very few states where hearings exist, I think the thing that was noted is the stark contrast of lack of competition in those states. That in effect, what you are setting up through a rate hearing process is akin to what we see with public utilities, where you effectively have a monopoly of one or two primary carriers that dominate the market in those states, and you have set in place what is effectively utility-style regulation for that in a non-competitive market. And that's a huge distinction between those states and what we have in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. And I appreciate those who are here for other bills, for you hanging in there. I think we're going to go, we might end up going a little bit over, but my plan is to try to get everybody in who signed up to testify on these bills. Then we'll go to 372 and then to 329. That might we might not get till 329 until, you know, close to the quarter of three, just to give people a sense of where we are. We only have a couple of people signed up to testify on 329, and I apologize if that's going to put a crimp in people's day. All right, let's move on. Could we please bring up Stella Kupperud, Holly Pruitt? Oh, okay. Let's bring up Stella Kupperud and Christine Chin Ryan.
Yeah.
Tupper. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Chills.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Stella Copperwood, and I am a real estate agent in Portland, Oregon, and I am self-insured and have been self-insured for 12 years or longer as a realtor. And my story is, in relation to this, is in January of 2005, I had purchased a private insurance policy. My premiums were $217 a month. By July of that same year, my rate went to $240 per month. A year later, it was slightly up to $258. So in December of 2007, I switched to a health savings account style policy, mostly because it was less expensive, and that brought my premium down to $239 per month. In September of 2008, my rate went to $371, and October of 2009, it was $425, and by the end of last year, it was $493 a month. It's been a great hardship during these last two very tough years in my business to keep that policy in effect, but I can't change policies. I can't shop the competition because I have a small pre-existing condition that I actually mentioned to my doctor what the condition was that was keeping me in the pre-existing condition category, and she said, that's ridiculous. So I am now a couple of years away from Medicare and unable to shop any policies. I am stuck in this policy. I can't even change to another policy in the same company because of this pretty minor pre-existing condition. In summary, my in a little less than 3 years, or about 3 years, my policy went from $239 to $493, where it is now. So rate increases. I would love to know the process by which these increases are granted, and maybe that can be a better understanding of what was happening before these things came up. I in all regards, support a public hearing policy on these matters. So I am definitely in support of these bills.
Thank you, Ms. Copper. Appreciate your testimony. Ms. Chan Ryan, please identify yourself and begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you for your time, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I'm Christine Chan Ryan. I am the founder and president of Synergy Consulting, Inc., an Oregon small business since 1988. I also serve as chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership and the Oregon Small Business Healthcare Initiative. As a small business owner, I am proud to say that I've always provided health insurance for our employees. I pay 100% of medical and dental premiums with low deductible, low out-of-pocket expense, and low co-pays. For many years, small businesses throughout Oregon have experienced annual double-digit increases in their healthcare premiums, which have detrimentally impacted the affordability and sustainability of health benefits offered to our employees and families. Here's my company's medical premiums history since 2001. From 2001 to 2002, we had a 40% increase. I changed insurance carrier with a 22% increase. 2002 to 2003, 10% increase. I changed insurance carrier again with a 7.6% increase. 2003 to 2004, 16% increase. 2005 to 2006, 10.5% increase. 2006 to 2007, 15% increase. 2007 to 2008, 13% increase. 2008 to 2009, 20% increase. 2009 to 2010, 32.7% increase. 2010 to 2011, a little over 3% increase. Today, many small businesses have been forced to forego these benefits, and many more are now facing the difficult decision to either offload these increasing costs onto employees or further reduce these essential benefits through minimal cut rate plans with high deductibles and co-pays, etc. The legislation before us today would provide significant improvements and protections for small businesses by ensuring that any future premium increases are subject to a fair and independent analysis, which is House Bill 716, establishes a public hearing process that involves the Attorney General, Senate Bill 717, enhances transparency and accountability by requiring that any future premium increases be justified and available to the general public via the Department Department of Consumer and Business Services website, Senate Bill 718, and grants the Department of Consumer and Business Services the necessary authority to determine whether premium rate proposals meet specified criteria and offers redress for the citizens of Oregon to contest future premiums, Senate Bill 653. Small businesses throughout Oregon desire to offer good wages coupled with good benefits, but have been literally priced out of the market by exponential increases in premiums for benefits that have become seriously compromised and eroded. Healthcare consumers throughout Oregon both deserve and demand the protections afforded by Senate Bill 653, 716, 717, 718. Senate Bill 717 is important to have public hearings for transparency and to make sure rate increases are reasonable and not excessive. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Jen Ryan. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We're now going to call business owner Holly Pruitt by phone, and then up next will be Kathy Kirshner and Diane Frank. Followed by John Galista and Ann Fisher. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Oh, and Robert Lee.
Hello, this is Holly.
Hello, Ms. Pruitt. This is State Senator Chip Shields, and you are live from the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. We appreciate you testifying on the four bills that we have before us. I will say we are running a little bit farther behind than I would prefer, so anything that you can do to keep your comments concise would be certainly appreciated by the chair, but take all the time that you need to make your point.
Okay, Senator Shields, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide testimony this afternoon, and hello to members of the committee. My name is Holly Pruitt, and I'm speaking today as the sole proprietor of a small business that's located in Portland, and my business provides organizational development and communication services to local, statewide, and national organizations. I have submitted a written copy of my personal story that goes into greater depth about the number of changes that I think are needed in the health insurance industry, but I'll speak only to those that are germane to the issue that you have before you today, particularly Senate Bill 717, which I see as an important start to bringing more transparency to the insurance industry. So the theory, I suppose, is that a more transparent process of rate setting involving public hearing and attended by the Attorney General, as in 717, will help keep insurance policies more affordable for small businesses like myself, who are definitely at risk of being priced out of the market. On the issue of affordability, my partner and I pay almost as much for our monthly health insurance premium as we do for the mortgage on our home in the Irvington neighborhood of Northeast Portland. Specifically, we pay $853 a month in a mortgage payment, and our health insurance premium is $759 a month. Now, it's important to note that that premium is not the price offered to me or available to me as a small business. It's the cost of COBRA coverage through my prior employer, which had a group size of over 100 employees. Now, that COBRA coverage is going to expire in 3 months, and as an indicator of just how opaque the insurance industry is, I've been unable to obtain any information on the cost of continued coverage. I know that I'm not going to be able to obtain an individual plan, which is what I carried for the first 7 years I operated my business before I took a job with benefits. That's because I've been labeled in the system as someone with a pre-existing condition, which is an issue that I addressed in my written testimony. Because of that, I've been told that my best bet is to use Oregon's fairly unique provision for individual portability, where the company that's covering me through my prior employer's plan will need to offer me an individual policy without going through underwriting. Now, I've twice tried to get information on that plan from my provider, which is one of Oregon's largest insurance companies. You know, what will the coverage be? What is it going to cost? And in neither instance could I obtain any information. Most recently, I was transferred literally 5 times from Oregon to Washington, back to Oregon, multiple offices. No one could tell me what it might cost to carry this portability policy on my own. They said I would need to wait for my COBRA coverage to expire, and then they could provide me with a quote, and assured me that I didn't need to worry about this gap in coverage because the subsequent coverage would be retroactive. But something seems very wrong with the system that requires you to be without insurance before you can find out the cost of your next hoped-for plan. So after I expressed my frustration with the customer service representative who was going to transfer me to a sixth time, she did explain to me that while they couldn't quote a price, it would certainly be much higher than what I'm currently paying because individual portability plans are, by their nature, for high-risk people. If you weren't high-risk, you'd go ahead and just buy an individual plan on the open market. And she suggested that maybe I'd have to be in the high-risk insurance pool. And as I detail in my written policy, I don't think I belong in a high-risk insurance pool. I'm healthy and I'm active and I am managing my one medical condition very responsibly with low-cost modalities. Now, I'm very concerned at this point about what the costs, still unknown, are going to be of obtaining health insurance coverage, either through individual portable plan or entering the high-risk insurance pool. Just as an illustration, even with my current high-cost COBRA coverage, I've just finished paying nearly $5,000 of out-of-pocket medical costs over the last 10 weeks. It's literally $8.30 short of $5,000 for the health care treatments, the low-cost, less invasive treatments that I've chosen that are detailed in my written testimony. For those services, the close to $5,000 that I've paid out of cost, how much should my insurance pay out? Just over $1,600 compared to my $5,000. Now, there are a lot of issues that go into that, but when I look at what I'm going to need to pay for a premium and premiums that are going to leave me with coverage that could result still in very high out-of-pocket costs, it makes me concerned that I'm not going to be able to continue to operate a small business. My partner is also a sole proprietor of a small business. I look at my contemporaries. I'm 48 years old, and I can count at least half a dozen who are not covered by employer-sponsored plans who have chosen to go uninsured, just hoping for the best and figuring in the worst-case scenario they'll just go through medical bankruptcy. So I definitely feel something's not done to make health care more affordable and available for entrepreneurs and small businesses like myself. I or my partner or both of us may be forced to close our small businesses, which provide cost-efficient and high-value services to vital community organizations in order to seek employment with benefits. So I appreciate you taking up these bills. I urge you to take action to require health insurance companies to justify their premium increases, especially in the individual and small group markets. I know my story illustrates multiple challenges in the insurance market, but I do believe that creating more transparency in premium rates is a good start. And I'll leave it at that and take any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. Pruitt. Any questions for in this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate you taking time away from your work today to present your point of view. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. And Kathy Kirchner is not here, so we will bring up Diane Frank and John Galista. And then we've got one more person, and then we'll move on to the next bills. No, two more. Sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Okay.
If you could please identify yourself.
Okay.
And give us your
thank
testimony.
You. I'm Diane Frank, and thank you for inviting me to this hearing. I'm here to testify in support of Bill 717. I am a sole proprietorship of a small company. I've been self-employed all of my adult life. For many years, I owned and operated a retail business in Eugene where we provided health insurance for our employees. However, the escalating cost of health insurance is becoming unsustainable. And like others before me, I'm going to talk talk to you a little bit about how they have impacted me. In October of 2007, my health insurance premium was $273 a month. In October 2010, it was $580 a month. I have been informed by my provider, LifeWise, that it will go up another 15% this year, making my total premium in the coming October of 2011, $667 a month. That's a $394 increase per month over a four-year period. This is just simply unsustainable. Small business people like myself, we have no options. We cannot, as others have testified, we cannot shop around. We cannot go through underwriting again. I'm fortunate. I have no pre-existing conditions, but I'm 62 years old. I cannot find another person to insure me. I have no choices. And that is a real problem when people have no options. I'm a light user of the healthcare system. I have a deductible of $2,500 per year. If I have a serious illness or an accident, the first $8,500 of any healthcare will come out of my pocket. That's on top of these and premiums that are just... I'm bending, but I'm starting to break, and I'm just like a lot of other small business people. We can't continue to do it, and I just really support some accountability. And I was struck by the fact that the people from the healthcare industry they offered their sympathy and they offered their empathy, but I have not seen any relief from these rate increases. It doesn't do me any good. I really want to see justification and accountability and a stabilization of these rate increases for people with modest incomes and no hope of making these significantly higher incomes to support these rate increases. We're stuck. It comes down to how much can you afford to lose. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. Mr. Galista.
Thank you, Chairman Shields and the rest of the committee. My name is John Galista. I own a small landscape company in Portland, Oregon. I'm also the legislative director for the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. Well, that sounds a lot. We've got 3 to 4 people on our committee, and we try to keep address the top of issues that affect our industry. Healthcare insurance and healthcare reform is a difficult thing to address, and as a small business owner, it's an important benefit for me to keep key employees on my staff. I started my small business to both provide health insurance, well, to make a living, but to also provide health insurance for myself and my family and the people that work for me. I incorporated in 1994. I was the only employee. Right now, I've got 8 full-time employees, and I run between 6 to 7 part-time employees, depending on the season. Our health insurance, because of our employees being younger, we've got a lower age demographic, and our rates for singles right now for this for 2010-2011 is $345 for a single and $995 for a family. We've averaged between 7 to 15% rate increases on an annual basis, and to deal with that within our industry, within my company, I've moved to paying 50% and having my employees pay 50% pre-tax. I don't know how long we can sustain to keep this as a benefit for our company. Therefore, I would urge your support in Senate Bill 717 to open up the public hearing process so I can at least talk to my employees and my industry about what's causing and bringing the increases in health insurance and to see if there's any possible way that we could have input into the process.
Thank you, Mr. Galista.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for coming down to give your testimony.
Of course.
Ann Fisher?
Good afternoon, Chairman Shields, Senators. My name is Ann Fisher, and I am here in sort of a multi-hat role. First, I am involved with Reasonable Insurance Premium Coalition, which is a group of small businesses who are trying to figure out how to handle health insurance premiums and how to handle their businesses. I'm also here as a lawyer who has had significant involvement in the Public Utility Commission. So when we talk about what a utility rate review is like compared to what you're describing here, I probably have a pretty good idea. Thirdly, I'm here as a small business owner myself. My husband and I have separate but combined offices. We're both lawyers. We have a total of 9 employees, and the two of us, and our health insurance premiums provided by one of the gentlemen who spoke run in excess of $600 per person per month. Our staff is less than 28 years old, so they tend to be 23, 22. We're facing a 10% rate increase, and if you multiply how much we pay per year, that's almost $85,000 we pay in health premiums for our employees per year. I'm hearing these other folks talking about their extraordinary efforts to pay $400. I got to say, there's extraordinary efforts to pay $600 or $700, and maybe I should change insurance providers. But that's not what I'm here to talk about specifically. And you might think that a law firm, even one with only 9 employees, would have the ability to pay these kind of premiums. But I got to tell you, in this economic market, there isn't a small business out there that can handle increasing insurance premiums. For a law firm, of course, people who have claims that they want to bring to court can't afford it anymore, in part because they know that the people they bring claims against might not be able to pay it. And the people who want to defend claims wind up just throwing up their hands and saying, I'll take the judgment because I can't pay that either. So where there are a lot of things that are going on for small business, and my practice is with small business only, that that tell me that this economic market, every dime and every penny is very important. I'm here to support all 4 of the bills. I know that some of the speakers have talked about 717 specifically, but 717, I think, works well and works in hand, and you ought not piecemeal it out, and you should pass all 4. Right now, the insurance rates are, to a large measure, set behind closed doors. Under the changes that were described by the insurance companies, there is a 30-day comment period. But I got to tell you, an insurance filing is a very complicated animal, and you have to have a fair amount of expertise to even unwind it. So to try to come up with an appropriate and effective remark after a short review is very difficult. And under the current program, the agency doesn't have to accept our comments. They just have to post them. They've gotten them. They don't have to be swayed by them, if you will. And we don't have the opportunity to go talk and lobby with the agency, but the insurance companies do on a routine basis. I personally have some problems with that. As I said, coming from the PUC experience, the regulator is held separate. While the staff may be involved with the utilities and they talk through issues, the regulators are off by themselves and they don't share that kind of information. The utilities themselves have a much greater obligation than the fairly nominal requirements that you have in these bills to produce information. This, to me, when I look at these bills just generally, I think these were a reasonable effort to balance the needs of the insurance companies with the needs of the public. It provides some ability to go behind the veil, if you will, to figure out or attempt to figure out what caused the increase in price or even the prices themselves. It perhaps will allow people to see the changes in quality among the different policies. For instance, one of the ways that some insurance companies keep prices down is to reduce the prices to the fees paid to providers or to reduce the benefits, both of which have a tremendous impact for people who have coverage or are trying to have coverage. When I look at these bills specifically,
653 sets out mandatory standards. Right now, they're discretionary standards, and discretionary standards are just that. They may be followed and maybe not. It also gives a right for a contested case hearing, and that's, you know, that I doubt what that will be on a routine basis, simply because it requires a person to just stand up, take a position, pay for somebody to represent them, or spend a lot of time trying to represent themselves, and it's not going to be taken lightly. The 716 provides an independent actuarial analysis, which we don't have now. We really have much more a conditioned analysis based upon what the insurance providers bring. And 717 gives an opportunity to have a hearing. And I think that's a benefit of both sides, because if the insurance director were to say, no, we're not going to approve your rate of 17.5% increase, but we can have a hearing, the insurer has the right and the ability to come in and explain why that rate increase is necessary. It doesn't cut them out of it, so to speak. On the other hand, it also gives the public, the people who are going to have to pay that increase, an ability to see what's causing it and to understand the problems. 718 requires some posting, and I think that's always important to give people the opportunity to see and to understand what are the issues. I know that there is some suggestion in the testimony I heard today by the insurance carriers that this will somehow be a burden. But if you look at what we have today, it's really slanted toward the insurers. It's entirely discretionary. We have a short period of time to review the filing. There's no checks and balances, meaning that there's no one standing over anyone's shoulder to say, is that an accurate representation? It is a change in standards, but it's not a change in standards that's going to take things too far. And the idea of looking at the solvency of the carriers is an important one. It raises the question, I think, of the balancing. It says we're going to balance the issues, and if it's going to put a carrier out of business, we don't want to go there. On the other hand, if there are places that we can save money, that we can change perhaps the terms and conditions to better meet the needs of the public, we can do that. I know that there was an observation that this would be defeat competition, but I think what you've heard today is there is no competition in health plans. If you have a pre-existing illness, however that is defined, and the health carriers define it very broadly, you can't move. If you get to a certain age, you can't move. If you have children, you can't move. And when you try to compare and find a different carrier, you are flummoxed by the terms and conditions that are hidden, the deductibles that you didn't know about, the premiums that can constantly be raised without much input on your own part. So, in short, I think that these four bills are a reasonable approach to meet the needs of both the consumers and the insurance companies. And speaking specifically on behalf of small business, we can't take it anymore. We can't continue to pay these prices, and we need to have the ability to at least see why they are occurring and perhaps change the dynamics.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fisher.
Thank you.
Questions for her?
Thank you. Oh, and by the way, Senator Bonamici's my senator.
Thank you.
All right. I think I forgot to get the last person, Robert Lee. Robert, are you still in the room? He is not. So, colleagues, we've got a lot to mull over. I will be getting together with you over the next couple of days and try to get your input on where we should go to try to keep health insurance premiums down for small business. So, with that being said, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 653, 716, 717, 718, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 372. Patrick, do you want to see this up for us?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 372 allows an injured person to retain from payments on claims of the injured person's reimbursement from both economic and non-economic damages prior to reimbursement of personal injury protection benefits that are paid by an insurer. It extends personal injury protection coverage for certain expenses from 1 year to 2 years after the date of injury. We have, and was provided to you previously, I believe, yesterday, this measure has been assigned a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. And again, just for the sense of the committee and those out there, I don't anticipate moving this today. But we will bring up Tom DeMore, Josette Anderson, and Neil Jackson, please, followed by John Powell and Steve Morrell. And Sean Miller. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator Shields, Chair Shields, and members of the committee. My name is Tom D'Amore. I'm the president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I represent primarily seriously injured persons making insurance claims. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 372, and I have Josette Anderson, who's going to testify about her particular case, and also my colleague, Neil Jackson. First, I'm an accounting major and a former CPA, so I sort of think in terms of numbers. In listening to some of the testimony today, I think one point that I want to make is that this is a very narrow bill in terms of insurance premiums. We've heard testimony today of $1,600 per family for health insurance premiums. In terms of PIP premiums, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $100 per year. So this is very narrow compared to some of the things and other bills you've already heard about today. In the standard personal injury auto case, and this is all about auto insurance, there's a portion of the policy that's called PIP, personal injury protection. In every case, typically there's three parties involved: the injured person, the PIP insurance carrier that pays for the medical bills, and the at-fault insurance carrier. And so those three parties work together on any injury claim. When a person suffers an injury accident, goes to the hospital, gets their surgical care, their company, the injured person's insurance company, pays for the medical bills, typically up to $15,000, and that's the mandatory minimum in Oregon. The at-fault insurance company waits until the end of the case, finding out how much treatment the person gets, what's the extent of their injuries. And then at the end of the case, it will either settle or it'll be decided by court what the value of the claim is. The at-fault party has a minimum insurance of $25,000, and so there's a lot of $25,000 policies out there. In a serious injury case, injured persons quickly spend their $15,000 of PIP coverage, and then if they spend their $15,000 of PIP coverage, they have to go out of pocket for the remainder of their medical expenses. In the example that I would use on a $25,000 policy, and up to this point, our legislation doesn't change a thing. Everything's the same. But up to this point, then when the $25,000 policy is paid by the at-fault party, and typically if someone has $25,000 in coverage, there's not going to be additional personal assets to go after. Of that $25,000, assuming $15,000 in medical benefits were already incurred, that first $15,000 is paid back to the PIP insurers, rather to the injured person. And so that's a shifting of those benefits between insurance companies. Under the current under the proposed legislation, instead of the insurance company being made whole or being reimbursed first, the injured person would be reimbursed first, and then any remaining funds would be given to the insurer after that. So that's the substance of the bill, that the injured person is put in place first, who actually paid the premium rather than the insurance company. From my discussion thus far, when we're talking about the PIP amounts or the PIP payments, it really is just a shifting of money between insurance companies. So there really is not a net effect. If we assume that there's just two insurance companies in the market, on half of the claims, one insurance company is going to be the at fault, and the other insurance company is going to be the one that's not at fault or paying the PIP premiums. So by this legislation, we're simply asking that the injured person be made whole first, the person that paid the premiums, rather than the PIP carrier. The second part of the bill, I think, is less controversial. PIP insurance, and the reason why the PIP premiums are so low, under the current law, it only lasts for 1 year. So after 1 year and 1 day, the PIP carrier is no longer obligated to pay medical expenses. This bill also seeks to expand that to 2 years, and so that's the second part of the bill. So in summary, we're simply asking to change the priority level so that the injured person, the person that has been injured, is made whole first instead of the insurance company. Then if there is additional funds or extra insurance, then that should go to the PIP insurer. So the bill simply switches priority. Oregon is one of four states with the most restrictive make-whole rules. 38 other states have more of a make-whole priority system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamore. Sorry.
And I'll introduce Josette Anderson, who was the victim of the prior law.
Chair Shields, Senators, my name is Josette Anderson, and I live with my husband, Patrick, in Sandy, Oregon. I just would like you to know that I really think these insurance companies are out of control, and so I'm here to tell you my story. My husband and I have been paying for our auto insurance coverage for over 13 years without any accidents. Our agent sold us a $100,000 PIP policy, telling us that it was secure coverage, and in case of an accident, when medical bills pile up, we would be covered. On January 22, 2009, I was driving back home from my sister's house when a pedestrian was stepping down off the curb, so I stopped. Another car rear-ended me. I was taken by ambulance to the hospital. They took x-rays, and I was treated with morphine for the pain. They sent me home with Percocet and told me to see my primary physician as soon as possible. The accident was on the weekend, so I saw my doctor the following Monday. She recommended me to see a specialist, and an MRI showed my tailbone was fractured. I was in a lot of pain. He prescribed a series of steroid injections over the next few weeks. He also prescribed surgically cementing my tailbone. I was also prescribed and attended many physical therapy sessions. For 13 years, we have been paying $100,000 in PIP coverage. Due to the accident, my medical bills are $44,000. The other driver had a $50,000 policy. Yet our insured sent me a letter saying that they were entitled to the first almost $30,000 of the $50,000 policy. I thought that we were paying for medical coverage, but I realized later it was like paying for a loan. I was told that the coverage for medical bills, that they would have been covered. So none of this makes any sense to me. I suppose they were hoping that I would just give up and go away. It's been 2 years since the accident, and we just got through arbitration a few months ago. I had to hire a lawyer to continue fighting for my reimbursement. No one should have to pay $100,000 PIP and have to go through this, especially after being injured. What's the point of having such a high-dollar policy coverage if it's not there when you need it? I don't want other Oregonians to have to go through what I went through, so I urge you to support this bill to make sure Oregon consumers get the insurance protection that they paid for. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm on the Board of Governors, the Oregon Trail Lawyers, here to support Senate Bill 372. I don't have a lot to add to what Mr. DeMoor and Ms. Anderson had to tell you, except I do want to emphasize that we've done more research, and 38 states provide better for the consumers under their PIP policies than Oregon does. That's not an enviable position for this state to be in. Washington has, they're a completely make-whole state, and their PIP is payable for 3 years, not one, not two. They have PIP available for 3 years. Their consumers, just across the river, they are made whole completely before there's any reimbursement to their insurance companies. And please understand, this does not apply to a small injury case. Give you a quick example to make it clear. It's a minor accident. The person treats for maybe 5 months, something like that. Maybe they've got $4,000 or $5,000 in PIP that is paid for by their carrier. This change in the law will not affect that case. And from previous legislation, previous testimony, we're told by the carriers that up to 90% of their cases, the total value, the total settlement value of those cases is $10,000. So we're talking about not many cases that this will affect. However, the ones that this does affect, this change affects, is like Ms. Anderson, the people who really got hurt, who really have heavy bills, and they're going to end up with nothing because there isn't enough money, and their carrier is going to stand first in line. The consumer will stand behind them. The carrier gets paid first. It's the serious injury cases that this bill affects. It's not the little what we call fender bender whiplash cases. The carriers will continue to be reimbursed on those cases fully, and if what my friends in the insurance industry said on another bill last session, if that's 80 to 90% of the cases, this bill isn't going to affect their reimbursement at all. We think it's a good bill, and it affects the most seriously injured Oregonians, and we urge your support. Any questions? We're happy to answer.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say to Ms. Anderson, thank you so much for coming to tell your story. I'm trying to figure out, how much are you still out of pocket? How much have you lost and not been reimbursed?
I think it was $16,000 that went back to my own medical insurance company that covered this.
By the way, this bill doesn't affect medical reimbursement for health care plans. This only affects auto policies.
Right.
Thank you. Senator
Boquist. Hey, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question of, the president of the Trial Lawyers Association. I'm curious on the bill, but on line 8, how we get to holding whole, because we're changing from economic damages to pure damages, and then we're dropping the definition in 31.710. So I understand the scenario of where we're trying to go, but I'm trying to understand the language in the bill and how that accomplishes what you just said.
Well, if we change the language to non-economic damages, then that would mean that the person has to be made whole in terms of their economic damages and their non-economic damages before the insurer is reimbursed their PIP benefit.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow-up.
So then it changes it from not just being reimbursed for all damages and making them whole for damages out of pocket, it changes it to complete damages all the way across the board. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it would also include future damages, too. If they're going to have future out-of-pocket costs, it would apply to that also.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Can we bring up John Powell, Steve Merle, and Sean Miller? And colleagues, thank you for hanging in there. I would like to still get to 3:29 if you can stick around a little bit past 3:15. Okay. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me is Mr. Steve Merle. Steve is an employee of State Farm and has worked as a claims attorney for that company for a long time. Mr. Chairman, I would just turn it over to him at this point. I have some closing comments. Thanks.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Merle, State Farm Insurance Companies. Just to kind of start out, I'd like to give a little context. Personal injury protection coverage, known as PIP, is mandated on every automobile insurance policy sold in Oregon. It provides five benefits. Medical benefits up to $15,000 mandated for 1 year from the day of loss. If you're employed and not able to work as a result of your injuries, 52 weeks of wage loss benefits of a maximum of $3,000 a month. If you don't work, you do stuff around the house, you have to hire somebody outside your family to come in, it pays a benefit of $30 a day for that up to 52 weeks. The fourth thing it does is there's a child care benefit if you're in a hospital and have to hire somebody to take care of your children. And finally, if somebody dies, there's a fatality. This is a no-fault add-on law that was brought to Oregon in the 1970s as part of what was perceived as a national insurance crisis at the time. Today, what happens when we pay personal injury protection benefits, if no one is at fault, that just becomes part of the rates and part of the ultimate losses. It's a no-fault coverage. However, when the law was enacted in 1973, if there was a party at fault, we are allowed to recover our money from that party with one very, very important limitation. The insured has to be made whole on their economic losses prior to the insurance company being able to recover their PIP money. That means all their out-of-pocket, they've got to be satisfied both present and future before we have the right to get into the liability insurance policy of the other company. What this bill seeks to do is to change that from not just the out-of-pocket, but for the less certain pain and suffering, non-economic damages made whole rule. Now, there are 13 states today that have PIP. State Farm as a company, in six of those states last year, had such bad loss experience that not only did we not make money on PIP, we lost money on all profit on all the auto coverages because of those states. And PIP has our attention nationally. It has our attention in Oregon in the PAC Northwest zone, which is composed of Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii. Oregon is not one of those six states that wiped out a profit. But PIP is one of four issues that we're looking at in our zone, specifically Oregon PIP, as being under cost pressure. What this bill will do is it is not an overburdening thing that's going to break, but it's going to add to an already difficult cost pressure situation. We've tracked down, we feel like the cost pressures we have are from four reasons. Two of them are legislative. One is judicial. And one of them is, I think, part of what you were hearing today in general, is there is just cost pressure on medical costs. We are part of that system. We have cost pressure that feeds into rate need. The two pieces of legislation that have hit and started to come home to us as far as causing cost pressure is first, in 2003 or so, we tied reimbursements under PIP to the workers' compensation fee schedule. Before that, there was no control as to what a provider could charge. So there was some sort of way of saying, okay, a consumer's got to be able to get more benefits with this money. And we tied to that fee schedule. The hospitals didn't like that and came in 2005, at least partially uncoupled from the fee schedule. So they get paid more generally under the fee schedule than they would otherwise. Last session, 2009, we raised the wage loss benefit. Oh, and back to the fee schedule, at that time we also raised the medical from $10,000 to $15,000 minimum. So we were saying we're going to give a consumer more money and the ability to buy more benefits with it. The hospitals were decoupled somewhat from the fee schedule, but the limits still stayed at $15,000. Last session we raised the wage loss benefit from a maximum of $1,250 a month to $3,000 a month. We weren't certain what that would do at State Farm to our rate need. What we're seeing now is having a bigger impact than we ever thought it would. The final piece that is causing pressure that we see is a judicial decision called Grisby versus Progressive Insurance Company. The legislature, when they set up PIP, knew there may be disputes as to how much is owed. And they provided a safe harbor provision from the normal provision of when an insured sues an insurance company and succeeds, they're allowed their attorney's fees. The legislature would rather see these cases arbitrated, but you lack the ability to mandate arbitration because of another Supreme Court case in Oregon called Molodi versus Truck Insurance Exchange. In order to facilitate arbitration, quick and inexpensive resolution of those disputes, You built a safe harbor into the attorney fee statute that said if we, as an insurer, agree that there's coverage and agree to arbitrate any dispute, then there are no attorney's fees. The Grisby case has basically made it so attractive that even in cases where we admit coverage, the court has said that coverage and costs, or what's owed, come so much together they can't separate them, and the result is you essentially have attorney's fees in every case. So that's kind of, I think, where we are in PIP. We're under a lot of pressure cost-wise. None of these pieces of legislation or activities, none among themselves, look like a great deal, but it has added up to increasing rates for PIP in Oregon.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. John.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Appreciated, of course.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. You do have my written comments, Mr. Chair, I handed out, as well as some written comments from Oregon Mutual. And I just want to maybe just briefly expand upon the cost pressures that Mr. Merrill talked about. And I want to just reference in my testimony, on the second page of my testimony, is a memorandum from DCPS, from the Teresa Miller, the administrator of the insurance division. The memo is to Senator Devlin, Senator Bonamici, who was chair of the committee last session, Representative Holvey, and Representative Wingert. And it was a request, a data request, to actually look at the cost pressures that this bill would provide to the industry and the policyholders if passed and signed into law. And so I just want to summarize those, that in summary, the insurance division concluded, after looking at the top 10 insurers and receiving that data from the top 10 insurers, that the estimated the result would be a 21.5% average increase in personal injury protection premiums for Oregon drivers. So if you take that with the average PIP premiums paid in Oregon, roughly $55.6 million of a PIP increase to Oregon drivers in Oregon. So, you know, the cost impact, I just wanted to have the committee have that information from last session, because essentially it's the same bill from last session, and so it's the same applies. And so just here today to express our opposition to the bill, Mr. Chairman, and you have my written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, if I might, again, John Powell with State Farm Insurance Companies. Again, just two basic points. One, the rates for this coverage are established primarily by the claims costs, what is paid out. So the degree to which an insurer recovers lowers the premium to the consumer and makes this coverage more available. And finally, to the point raised by Representative Boquist, it's clear by reading the bill what it does do. It simply adds non-economic damages to this coverage. And that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, was what, when PIP was put in as a no-fault portion of your automobile insurance to cover first parties, people in your car, yourself, and the exception to that is a pedestrian. If you hit a pedestrian, they're covered by PIP. But this was put in the law not to replace health insurance, not to replace other coverages, but to make sure there was an immediate payment being able to be made to providers and to protect those first parties, not to turn this into a liability form of coverage, which would then extend to pain and suffering and that sort of thing. So cost was, and I've listened to the tapes back in the early 70s when this bill was passed, the insurance commissioner at the time was very concerned about the cost of this coverage. And you heard mention about how Oregon ranks in terms of PIP. 13 states now have a PIP coverage, a more comprehensive medical coverage. Other states have very limited medical type of coverages. This is a very, very good coverage for Oregon consumers. And I think the last state to do away with it was Colorado. And they've done it at the request of consumers because of price. So we don't want to get to that point, and we urge you not to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Real quickly,
I'll bring it up later.
Great, yeah. If you could bring it up offline, I sure would appreciate it. So we have two other people. What I'm inclined to do, since Ms. Butterfield is in the building frequently, is to roll over her testimony till Monday. But I would like to bring up Ms. Jean Stalker,
You're more than welcome to come up if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, I remember it.
I know you're not a professional lobbyist, I presume. So
no.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Stalker, and I work as an insurance agent for Safe and Sound Insurance in Woodburn, Oregon. As an independent agent, we typically sell for more than one company and help consumers choose the one that's best for their needs. It's been my experience that in what I do, I deal mostly with low-income consumers. Typically, they've been labeled as high-risk, and what happens is that it's not high-risk. The high-risk category, it's not just people who have poor driving records, you know, or, you know, have failure to pay, you know, issues because they're not responsible. It ends up being families, you know, and responsible people who just are having difficulty in today's economy with the cost of living. And so we just end up hearing so many stories about people's finances and about how am I going to pay, you know, for my insurance more and more, especially over the course of the last couple of years. You know, personal injury protection, contrary to some of the testimony, it is an expensive coverage, you know, on a personal auto policy. And when they had given the estimate of it costing over $55 million, I believe it would disproportionately affect low-income people. So I just want to urge you to not pass this bill and try and keep insurance affordable, you know, for everyone, especially those low-income people that I serve.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Is that okay, Lana? Did you have testimony you needed to give too?
Simply that we oppose the bill.
that's the kind of concision we appreciate around here. Thanks. All right. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 372, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 329. I believe. Oh, perfect timing. Senator Bates, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator, District 3, and just to show that there's no conflict of interest, this does pertain to health care, but not directly to me, I don't believe, in most cases, although it's possible it would. So there might be a conflict of interest, but on very rare occasions. So let me catch my breath here. I just walked in from another committee. Let me get oriented a bit. Senator Shields, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for hearing this bill. Senate Bill 329 really addresses two issues, the first of which is pretty straightforward. The second is going to be a policy decision that, in your collective wisdom, I hope you can resolve for us. First part is that there is an issue at times when an insurer or a carrier, instead of paying the person or the institution that actually performed the service, pays that directly to the individual. And that becomes very problematic at times for the individual to collect that. I'll give you an example of it, which you take from my own life, which you might enjoy hearing. I had a family one time many years ago that was in a car accident. We spent a great deal of time getting through that and recovering from it. And at the end of that time, they said to me, you know, Dr. Bates, you make a lot of money and we don't. And we've never been to Disneyland, so we're going to go to Disneyland and you're not going to get paid and we're changing doctors. Now, that's rare, but it does happen sometimes and it makes you wonder what you're doing sometimes. But it's one of those things that happens. It can be a lot more serious than that for other people who have this as a routine part of their issues as far as running a business, especially freestanding surgical centers, hospitals, and other large institutions. So the issue of paying the provider versus the individual is not a problem except in one case, and that's the case of whether they're in or out of what's called the provider base. By that I mean a lot of institutions and a lot of physicians are on a panel that is included in that carrier's base, and some are not in that base. They've either been excluded for various reasons that they want to have an exclusive panel or a limited panel, and that's where the other issue becomes involved. I think the first part of this, of paying directly to the institution or individual, is probably not a big issue for you as long as that institution or provider is inside the panel by that carrier. When it's outside the panel of the carrier, you have a different issue. very different issue and one you're probably going to think about for a while. I look at this from the point of view of what's best for the patient in the long run and what's best for the system in the long run. There are reasons not to have individual physicians, nurse practitioners, and institutions in a panel. Some of those are related to trying to limit the expenses of the carrier. Some of those are pertaining to actually better outcomes, potentially. I'll give you some examples of what that might look like. Let's say an individual needs or has pain in their knee and thinks they need a knee replacement. They go to a provider, and the provider says, under your insurance, we have to try some other things first, some physical therapy, maybe something called a synvisc injection, maybe some cortisone in your knee. Let's see if that'll take care of it first. If that patient goes to someone outside the panel who happens to make a living replacing knees, they might say, Doc, I want this knee replaced as quickly as possible. I do not want to go through anything else. And they get a knee replacement, and the bill is sent to the carrier. And then you have a decision to make here. Was that the right avenue to follow for this patient? Would they have been better off inside the panel with conservative treatment before they went to surgical treatment or not? The other half of that argument is this a tool used by insurers simply to control their premium payments and control their costs by forcing people to go into a specific panel where there might be a long wait to get in to be seen and have less choice for the patient? That's a little bit of a Solomon's choice for you. And I recognize that as a very difficult one to go through. And one you're going to have to think about and talk about here amongst yourselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the good chair will lead you in that discussion. I have mixed emotions and mixed thoughts on it, and I'm sure he does too. As a minimum, the bill before you resolves the first question. If you're in the panel, you should be paid directly by the insurer to that panel. We don't want this going on, the policy and the practice of occasionally, it's rare now, but occasionally, cases where the individual who's been received the treatment has been paid and the provider or whether it be an institution or individual inside the panel is not paid directly. We want to stop that practice. It's a rare one now, but we still see it occasionally. The second part of this question, which are, I believe, the -1 amendments, is the question of, if you're outside of the panel, can the money still be sent directly to the individual and not to the provider? That is a tougher question, and I'm going to leave it to your collective wisdom to make that decision, which is sort of kicking it down the road from my point of view, but one that's a tough decision for you all, and I think you'll have probably a fairly robust discussion about this, being able to listen to both sides of the equation and both sides of the question before you make your final decision on the amendments. So, Chair Shields, I'd like to leave immediately before you ask me any questions, because I think I know where they're coming from, but I will stay and answer questions for a few moments if you'll have some for me.
No, thank you. Any questions for Dr. Bates? Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two people coming up behind you.
Okay. I hope I've laid the question out fairly clearly for you for the -1s versus the basic bill.
I believe so,
that distinction.
I believe John Powell will come up and present the case for the -1s. We don't have the -1s in our possessions yet.
Okay.
In our possession yet. But,
Mr. Chair, are you going to continue? Because we have a meeting.
How many of you can you wait for?
I have a 3 o'clock.
All right.
I have a 2:45.
Well, since we're waiting for the amendment anyway, I want to at least get David Schlachtis to come testify, since he's not in the building as frequently. And John, would it be okay for you to come back on Monday? Great, thank you. Please come forward.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks,
Dr.
Bates.
I'll step aside.
Suzanne, if you need to.
Chair Shields, committee members, thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Hoke Orthopedics of Oregon. It's an orthopedic medical group and a surgery center. We're actually just down the street, a couple blocks away. I'm here to testify on behalf of our organizations and also on behalf of the surgery centers in the state of Oregon in favor of Senate Bill 329 as it's written. I know that you're all needing to leave, so I'll keep my comments incredibly short. Senator Bates was very eloquent in stating what those issues are. We completely support the fact that payment needs to be made directly to the providers. It's one thing if it's a $35 office visit and the payment goes to a patient. If it is a surgery, if it's going to a surgery center, if it's going to a hospital, and you're talking $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 now, that patient has the opportunity, which they do do on occasion, where they'll say, "Well, yes, I know I got $1,500 from the insurance company, but I'll be happy to pay you $100 a month," which then creates a cash flow problem for the physicians. We all know that physicians' reimbursement levels are going to be strangled. We know that they are going to be cut shorter and shorter. So anything that we can do to prevent additional cash flow problems to physicians, to hospitals, to surgery centers is incredibly important. And passing this bill as it's written is incredibly important. I know the insurance companies will come up here and they'll say, "Well, but that's our one piece of leverage that we can get providers to participate in our panels." The flip side of that, of course, is that they forget to tell you that a lot of times they're offering us contracts and contracted rates that are horrible. I mean, we literally end up canceling contracts with insurance companies, not because we want to, but because the rates that they're offering us are terrible. We lose money on Medicare. We lose money on OHP, and there's a lot of insurance companies that want us to accept those rates, and we just can't do it. We know that we have to make more money on the commercial contracts so we can afford to take care of the Oregon Health Plan patients and afford to take care of the Medicare patients. With this bill, we'll be able to continue to do that because payments will continue to come to us directly. We won't have to argue with the patients or send them to collections in order to get paid for the services that we provided in a fair manner. So we ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? All right. This is going to be a longer discussion. We're still waiting to see John's Dash 1 amendment, and we'll continue this discussion on Monday. So, colleagues, thank you for hanging in there. We are going to close a public session and public hearing on Senate Bill 329. I do want to introduce this committee measure, so I will open public hearing for the purpose, or I'm sorry, work. I will open a work session for the purpose of introducing as a committee measure LC 3940, dated 2/28/2011. Senator Monroe.
Move introduction of LC 3940 as a committee bill with again, this caveat that a vote in favor of introduction does not mean support or opposition to the bill.
That's right. If that had not be the case, there'd be many wasted political lives along the road of this session, wouldn't there? So, yes, voting for this does not mean you are supportive or in opposition. So is there any discussion?
Yeah, same disclaimer.
An additional disclaimer. I am a recipient of PERS, and whether this may affect me, I'll make that as a disclaimer. I may have a conflict of interest or something on this. Don't know. Haven't read it carefully, so I'm not sure. But
in an abundance of caution, I also am in the PERS system, not yet a recipient.
And I want to reduce the cost in PERS system, so but I'll still vote for the introduction.
Great. So, any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Colleagues, thank you so much for staying, and we appreciate all of your testimony. This meeting's adjourned.